Hello, Emily Wright.
Hey, Sam McClary. I've got a voice several octaves lower than usual.
Yeah.
I quite like it.
It's quite good.
It's a good radio voice.
It is a good radio voice. You sound...
To go with my radio face today, I feel dreadful.
Oh.
No comment, I noticed.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something nice to say, but it's not in me.
Nothing came to mind, did it?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So it feels like it's been a long time.
It has been a long time. I wasn't here last week. And then the week before... I can't remember.
Oh, I don't think you were there. We had to meet the Tech Talk Academy finalists the week before, and then we had the Tech Talk Academy final.
If anyone's missed me, I'm back.
There she is. Well, you can't see her, but or hear her proper voice, but...
I'm here.
There's one. So we've had quite a busy week in terms of things that EG has been doing.
Yeah.
Two summits in 1 week.
Yeah, it reminds me of that Four Seasons in one day.
Yeah, or there's the Seven Summits, which adventurers do, which is I think it's seven.
Oh, I think if you speak to some people here, it probably felt like seven summits.
Yeah.
A lot to get through.
It was a lot to get to, but both were very good. So the first was the Industrial and Logistics Summit, which was very heavily influenced by tech, actually. A lot of talk around automation, last mile, and... sort of finished with an idea or the thought that there was a two-tier market that existed in industrial, in that, you know, automation would affect and impact the growth of the last mile delivery, but that, you know, those traditional sheds in the Golden Triangle would remain as traditional sheds, and whereas automation is sort of pushing for multi-use of logistics that you would see in the sort of urban logistics world, but you're never going to see houses built on top of a massive mega shed up in the Midlands.
Yeah.
Which made sense.
Yeah. I wasn't there at that summit, but from what I'm hearing in the market and people I'm speaking to, I'm sure this won't come as a massive surprise to anyone listening, as, you know, all of our readers and listeners have their fingers firmly on the pulse, but... You know, industrial logistics really is one to watch at the moment. It's sort of that you know, a year ago, 18 months ago, it became, you know, the surprise sexy sector.
Mm-hmm.
And now that it is being disrupted by technology, I think it's really going to be quiet. I'm not going to use the word exciting or interesting. I think it's going to be a really, really innovative space, more so maybe than people think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that... at both of those summits we had this week, the keynote speeches were from people who are not at all in property. Yeah. So at the logistics, we had Chris Middleton, who is a journalist, but also a robotics expert. So he was there talking about the rise of robotics and, you know, no background in real estate, but there was this group of, you know, very traditional real estate people, you know, sort of hanging on his every word. So that was really interesting. And then obviously later in the week, you chaired our Offices and Workplace Summit.
I did.
Which again had a non-real estate keynote.
Bruce Daisley. We had this discussion actually. So he's VP for Twitter. Do you say EMEA or EMEA?
I would say EMEA.
Yeah. Well, I realised as I introduced him, I didn't know which one was the right way.
What did you go for?
I didn't.
Oh. Did you say EMEA?
I said VP of Twitter and didn't think anyone would really notice. Oh. But actually, that maybe kind of
promoted him.
Yeah. So he didn't mind. He was great, and he was. What was really interesting about him was he obviously wasn't talking about stuff from a real estate background, but neither was he there talking about. An occupier, from an occupier's stance, really, to the room, and we have had, you know, people want to hear from the tech giants and the you know, the innovative financial services companies about what they want as an occupier. So Bruce is a workplace commentator as well as being VP of Twitter EMEA, and he has a podcast that people might well have heard of because it's often at the top of Apple's business podcast league. It's called Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. Or eat, work, sleep, repeat.
Eat, sleep, work, repeat.
Yeah.
I
think think that is it. Sorry, Bruce, if we've got that out of order, but the four words are definitely the right four words.
I'm not sure he'd say ours right either.
Yeah, fine. So, and he was talking a lot around the fact that we work harder because of our mobile phones, and I don't think that will come as a surprise to anybody, but he really, really delved into what that actually means and what the output of that is. So over the last 10 years, having a mobile phone has increased people's work day by 27%.
2 hours, wasn't it?
Yeah, so 7.5 hours to 9.5 hours. And that's just the increase of the working day. And then you've got the fact that people feel this pressure to be constantly online checking their emails, whether or not it's a Monday morning or a Sunday afternoon, and how pointless that is. And then how it pervades your everyday work life. And he has a great quote where he said, the problem is that, you know, social skills in the office have gone through the floor because you'll be trying to talk to somebody, but actually, even if you don't realise it, all you're thinking is, oh, I've got 200 emails or 50 emails and that's what I need to do. And it's drawing us away from talking to people. And he said that, ironically, the industries that need that spark, the creative industries, are the ones that tend to be governed by people who are obsessed with checking their mobile phones, being online. And he said it's driven by this fear of missing something. If you miss something, you get something wrong, you miss an email, and the whole world will cave in. And of course it won't cave in.
It's not FOMO, it's FOMS.
Fear of missing something.
Yeah.
And it won't cave in. And he said that there had been some tests done where staff had been asked to not check their emails in the evening for a week. And the sample size was so small that they couldn't go ahead with the experiment. So they said, okay, a day. So they did it for a day, and it was so successful that most of the people that did that are now still doing it. So
it was interesting, wasn't it, that someone from Twitter was telling an audience to turn off their notifications.
Yes, and I did actually call him up on that when I came up to ask a few questions on stage, and I said, you know, it's all very well what you're saying about email, but you work for one of the biggest, noisiest social media outlets in the world. And he said, well, it's more of a news feed. I mean, I think it would be considered either. But he was very good, actually. He said, yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend you sit in bed reading Twitter at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Which obviously, you know, I don't know. Do you do that?
No, I'm asleep at 3 a.m.
Are you?
Yeah.
I mean, I wake up. I'm surprised and like, that's unusual. I mean, that's normal.
Yeah. I mean, I do wake up not long after that, but
what's the first thing you do when you wake up?
Turn off my alarm or feed my cat.
Okay. Alright.
Who's jumped on my head. And then usually to see how much love I've got on Instagram, if I'm honest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're one of those people.
Yeah, it's really upsetting. But I like it. And then I, you know, look at other people's lives and think they are so unlucky that they don't come to EG Towers every morning. That's exactly what I think.
Oh,
you?
Okay. No, I was saying.
But that was, you know, his whole point was, you know, he was talking about, it was interesting that he's a workplace summit full of real estate people, and we didn't really talk about the physical bricks and the mortar. Yeah. It was about, you know, you can't really design for productivity. Productivity comes from the people, and we don't build people. And so if you want, you know, a space is important, but more important than that is making sure that the people in that space are happy and have slept. And you know, and feel empowered to do things. And having, you know, free beer or beanbags might help some people, but others it won't.
Yeah, didn't he say that that's like, it's a smoothie delusion?
Yeah.
So you can, he said it's the biggest misconception if you give people free stuff and benefits that they work harder. He said actually it adds to their stress, and it gets that kind of, it actually gets the cortisol going again. It's that kind of like reward thing that you get that buzz. And he said it's the equivalent of going out and getting, his words, going out and getting smashed on Prosecco. It feels great. I think he said it feels glorious at the time, but not long term. And that's the equivalent of giving someone a smoothie or a free, whatever it might be, that's a free biscuit. I mean, that's kind of base level.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. And it was nice listening to him, because actually what he did quite cleverly, I think, and maybe he didn't even realise he'd done it, was he kind of delivered a sort of mental health awareness, well-being sort of keynote wrapped up in some really great stats and very impressive ways of approaching things. And people in this industry, rightly or wrongly, still do sometimes tend to switch off when people say well-being.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great that he had managed to get that across. And also get across really neatly the fact that we all feel very pressured. And he put it perfectly. He said, we're always checking our email, because if we're not on email, we frankly feel like we're a bit shit at our jobs. And that is exactly it.
Yeah.
And it's not true.
No, you're not shit at your job.
Thank you. I was going to say, I'm always on email. it doesn't seem to make any difference for me.
And I think, you know, as much as he didn't mention real estate, there was plenty for real estate professionals to take away, wasn't there? There was, you know, well, he sort of blamed the industry for designing out creativity, didn't he, with
wretched, horrible open plan.
Yeah, that was good.
I was hanging off his every word, you see. I remember what he said.
Yeah, well, because you hate open plan.
I really do. I'm not a huge fan, no, I have to say.
Yeah. And then, obviously, about the coffee machine being the hub of activity and where most exchanges take place. And then he had a really interesting study, didn't he, about lunch tables.
Yeah, he did. And actually, I'm sure there are companies across London and across the country and across the world that do this, but one company that has been doing this for a long time is Appear Here, and we'll go back to that. But what he said was that we were talking about, you know, the asset itself, not actually being able to fuel productivity, but what it can do is that a small change can fuel a culture change that can then fuel productivity. So he said the second biggest driver of productivity or sociability in the office, which leads to a happier workforce, was the size of the tables that you put in the social areas where people have their lunch or whatever it might be. And, you know, you think, okay, fine, that makes sense. But it goes beyond just then you sit with more people at lunch. He said, you know, if you put tables out where 3 or 4 people can sit around, people get conditioned in the workplace to talk to 2 or 3 people at a time. And what then happens is that is mirrored in the way they work at their desks, and they will tend to only talk to the people next to them or opposite them. If they're sitting at a table where 8, 9, 10 people can sit, not only are they likely to, obviously, it's a numbers game, meet more people from around the office, but they will get used to engage. It sounds ridiculous, isn't it? We've forgotten how to engage, but they will get used to engaging with larger groups of people, which will then make them feel more confident about talking to more people throughout their day. And that should then fuel that sociable element of work and the chat element of work, which not only makes work more fun, but in any industry, but particularly the creative industries, is where so many ideas and thoughts come from, when we're just so sort of set on our mobile phones. But I do remember a few years ago going into Appear Here's office, and for anyone that's been into Appear Here's office, it's not that big, but every Friday they put out a really long trestle table for lunch, and everybody sits down together for lunch. And I think even doing it one day a week probably does have the desired effect that it gets people used to talking to each other and being a lot more extrovert and sociable.
And I think, excuse me, sorry.
Passing on my germs.
You are. And I think, you know, that is we all love, don't we, going to, shameless plug, Wagamamas and things like that, and sitting down on those tables with lots of people, because it has that buzz. And we'll play you the Bruce's speech very shortly, but we're going to...
We won't need it now. I mean, we've basically...
We have. I mean, I think he might say it a bit better than us.
Yes,
but we'll butt up against that another piece that's come from the Tech Talk Academy with Matt Rice, who looks after the Facebook tool called Workplace. And his point was that we have to take how we communicate outside of work into work now, and that's where what the innovative companies are doing. And I'll get to that because of the table, and that, you know, we're used to going to Wagamamas and places like that and sitting on tables and interacting with people, so why wouldn't we do that in the office? We've seen it in the hotel industry, haven't we, that people go to hotels are now designing bedrooms and things so that people want to take that stuff home and put it in their homes. There is that real blurring between social life and work life. And in some ways, as Bruce was telling us, that's not a good thing. But in other ways, though, business can learn from how we communicate outside of work.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's nice. It was a very, the whole, both those keynotes. I don't use this word very often, not because it in regards to this industry, not because it's not true in some sense, but it was very true in the sense that it was actually quite uplifting. I think that when we get bogged down a lot by very important things that are happening in this industry all the time, you know, all the financials and everything, and then we also get bogged down by a lot of external political stuff that's happening, a lot of uncertainty. And I wasn't at the industrial logistics, but the Offices and Workplace Summit had a really positive, light feel to it, kind of a very innovative feel, and a feel that people are kind of, you know, now on the same page. It seemed like there was a lot less friction between different parts of the sector, and everybody's sort of thinking quite sensibly, and a lot of consideration being given by developers and investors as well to the way people feel about things. And I really hope that's going to make it much less of a taboo subject, because it does matter. And if companies listening to this think, well, it doesn't really, it does, to your bottom line.
Yeah.
So it's worth thinking about.
It is. And, you know, for years the real estate industry has been saying, oh, you know, it's not about bricks and mortar, it's about the people. But now it feels like actually they believe what they're saying.
Yeah, it's time to invest in it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to leave you now for, well, it's probably about half an hour for you to listen to both Bruce and Matt, and then we'll be back after this.
Well, I'm fascinated to be here. We mentioned there that I do this podcast, Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, and I largely got into doing that out of a curiosity and interest in the way that work's changing. And in fact, on next week's, I'm chatting to Bjarke Ingels, the architect who designed the new Google landscaper, out of a fascination for how architecture and work culture are coming together. I was fascinated yesterday to see the Guardian report. I don't know if anyone saw the report about the Francis Crick Institute, which is that beautiful structure down in near Euston, with an open plan of 1,500 seats. And the issue they're having is that all the people who are there are struggling to get anything done. So how architecture intersects with work culture is obviously probably one of the biggest issues right now. And all I'm going to do, I'm going to give you a stock take of exactly what works like right now, based on me having chatted to 40 experts and tried to sort of pick the brains of academics and scientists. And largely where I've ended up is that to understand work culture today, you have to understand as much about neuroscience and how our brains work as about as anything else. So I'm going to go into a perspective of that. Broadly, there's two macro trends that are going on that I think work culture represents the intersection of. Clearly, there's sort of a consideration about the way that work has evolved in the last 10 years, and the mobile phone has really transformed the way that our jobs and our work impacts us. In the last 10 years, the average working day of British people has gone up from 7.5 hours to 9.5 hours because of the arrival of the mobile phone. And I always think of Bob Crowe, the late Bob Crowe. As much as any time anyone heard Bob Crowe's name, it was sort of through gritted, you'd hear it and you'd say it through gritted teeth. Bob Crowe was the late leader of the Tube Union. But do you remember, when Bob Crowe was in charge of the Tube Union, there was nothing that happened without a concession. The Tube could not change the working hours, the working practices, without the Tube Union getting something in return. Now, we should have channeled the spirit of Bob Crowe when it came to accepting 2 hours more work every day on our phones, because I seem to remember when that happened, we were all pretty much pestering the IT guy that we were the next people to get BlackBerrys and HTC devices. And we were all desperate to get this thing that's basically increased the working day by a quarter. So that's one mega trend. The other trend is the consideration that's coming up, which is the idea that automation is going to have an impact on our lives and the robots are going to take over. I saw somewhere it said that any job that earns less than £30 an hour is likely to be at risk of automation. Here's why I think the current working environment is particularly relevant to, and a consideration of the people in the buildings that we're talking about is really vital. So that extra 2 hours a day is 27% longer. If you go from 7.5 hours to 9.5 hours, the working day's got longer. In fact, what you see as a pattern of that is that half of all people who check their email outside of work hours exhibit signs of high stress. And what you tend to find is that Cortisol is often described as a stress hormone. It's in fact just, it's like the acceleration pedal. Cortisol is just a signal to your cells, a signal to your body to do more. And what happens is if you live on cortisol, if you constantly do so, show that sign of checking emails outside of work, the end result is you tend to feel exhausted. So half of all people report being exhausted in the Gallup Workforce Survey. The Gallup Workforce Survey is brilliant at those things. It has a UK slice, it has a global slice, it has a US slice. So you can go in and see all these things. But it's a survey that's one of the longest running surveys of the workforce. And the UK stat is 78% of people report going to work to shut off. Now that's really relevant directly to two things. Look, we've always gone and been a different version of ourselves at work. Anyone who's familiar with their mum having a phone voice will recognise a degree of that. Did your mum? Maybe you have a phone voice. My mum, every time she picks up the phone, as an expression of what she used to do at work, she sounds a little bit posher than she does when she's chiding me. And obviously, that's because we used to manifest a different version of ourselves at work. The extreme of that in the Gallup Workforce Survey is people say they can't be themselves at work. That's particularly relevant back to that sort of automation, as the jobs that are going to remain in the next 20, 30 years are largely going to be those that have creative input to them. Not being yourself at work has an impact on that. And the final one is that these are UK stats. One in five sick days right now is stress-related. And in fact, what we've never seen the volume of outside of work stress and the volume of people checking emails, the blurring of the line between work and home has never been as sort of slim as it is now. And it is having a consequence on the increase in stress, but an increase in mental health issues. These are McKinsey stats. And McKinsey estimate that about a third of all of our working jobs is email. This is 4 years old, this survey, and I think this is already out of date. And they say half of our jobs are computer-related. So whether that's doing Word documents or PowerPoint or creating things, if you add to that a report I saw in Management Today a couple of weeks ago, that the average British person spends 16 hours a week in meetings. So two full days in meetings. So effectively, we're coming out of those meetings, sort of rubbing our eyes, going and doing emails for the rest of our jobs. We're finding sort of it's having a big impact on what we do. The reason why I think that's especially relevant is that increase in the working day is not captured in the productivity figures. In fact, if people were achieving something in that increase in the working day, productivity would have gone up. Now, here's two stats for you. The first, the top line is the US productivity. That US productivity growth is the lowest productivity growth, the slowest for two centuries. So even though the technological revolution that's transformed every office, the fact that every office in the last 20 years has got not only computers on every desk, but computers pretty much in every pocket, but the productivity growth that the US seen is lower than the last two centuries. The UK growth is even slower than that. In fact, the stats that came out 2 weeks ago are the UK productivity is in decline. So effectively, we've got, if you sort of take the state of the nation that I'm trying to express there, there's a lot of stats suggesting we're working harder than ever before, but the end result is it's not leading to any increase. So I'm sort of going to go through now a few things that I've seen that are emergent trends. And I think what's definitely going to happen over the next few years is there's going to be a real separation between different workplaces where working practices will be evolved and innovated in some places and remain unchanged in others. I definitely see that there's going to be sort of a twin track approach. I'll give you sort of, basically I'm going to go on and show some ways that we can change work, improve work, but I thought I'd start with two ways that you can be happier, full stop. So my perspective is I'm just interested in how we can be happier at work. And the number one way to be happier, full stop in life, is to sleep more. And anyone who believes that they don't need 7.5 to 8 hours sleep, the good news is there's some science that's checked that out. Anyone who says, of all the people who say they don't need 7.5 hours sleep a night, based on the scientific research, 95% of those people are wrong. So the number one way to be happier is to get more sleep. The number two way to be happier is to get happier friends. Now, I know this isn't always easy, but I'm proposing a segmentation system of friends, that these Saturday friends and Wednesday night friends. Now, if you like, if you accept a mum's logic, so mum's logic being that there's, that you can broadly separate people into drains and radiators, right? You can accept that idea that there's some people who they're like an effervescent, energising presence. You don't know why, but you sit down with that person and you feel happier just by being in their presence. That's a radiator. There's other people, and they can be fantastically, sarcastically hilarious, but they're drains. They're sort of, they see the downside of life. They're sort of quite dour. And I'm suggesting that that drain person might be a really nice Wednesday night, couple of glasses of wine friend. But the best friend to try and energise you and make you happier in your life, that's a Saturday friend. So the number two way, so before you even consider anything that work can do, actually, there's two ways to improve happiness there. One of the things that definitely has a big impact on the impact of our work and the way that that work affects the working culture is the culture of companies. And quite often, I think a better way to think about culture of companies is the tone of a company. Because some of the things that wouldn't overtly be expressed in a culture document, if you were to capture those things, have a big impact on the working environment. Number one thing for the tonality of a company, does your boss email at weekends? If your boss emails at a weekend, it actually has a massive impact. You would never capture that in a culture document. But if your boss emails on a Sunday, it has a massive impact on the stress levels of everyone in an organisation. So some of the things that the tonality has a really big part to play. I'll give you another illustration. Actually, a lot of Silicon Valley companies publish their, or tech companies publish their culture. And you find commonality in some of them. Both Uber and Amazon had a value in their culture documents that was conflict leads to better outcomes. And actually, if you compare those two organizations, the tone of those companies is very different. Amazon is an immensely introverted organization. Every meeting at Amazon starts with reading a document in silence for 10 minutes. And what they mean by conflict leads to better outcomes is they believe that everyone, once they've read this thoughtful piece, will then have a sort of engaged and spirited debate on it, where discussion is really highly valued. Conflict leads to better outcomes in Uber was all about, let's go and tackle everyone. The unwritten rule at Uber was break the rules, pay the fines. And so their philosophy was this agitating, deliberately bellicose approach to try and create conflict. So even though the culture documents might say the same, actually it's the tone of the company that has the biggest impact. Before I go into like five things that I think work's going to evolve, I'll just give you a perspective on things that don't affect culture. And one of them is the idea of what someone told me was the smoothie delusion, the idea that you can give modern workers and modern workplaces perks and benefits, smoothies, if you will, to make them happier. There's no evidence that giving people any perks or benefits has any impact on productivity and any impact on happiness at work. In fact, there's some evidence that the opposite's true. So any sort of philosophers or any people who've studied psychology will know the difference between hedonic pleasure. Hedonic pleasure can be absolutely magnificently enjoyable, don't get me wrong, and eudonic pleasure, which is sort of purpose. Hedonic pleasure is fleeting. Going out and getting smashed on Prosecco feels glorious in the moment, but doesn't have any enduring benefit on your life. Eudonic pleasure, doing things that actually sort of feel like they're either contributing to your own personal long-term happiness or society's long-term happiness, really helps. And in fact, the evidence on the smoothie delusion, this is a piece of work by someone at the University of Michigan. Employees who receive rewards for doing boring work and making themselves sick. So all of the evidence, if you look at bankers or people who receive big bonuses for work that they find wretchedly boring, they tend to exhibit signs of depression. So, you know, just a good sign, giving people smoothies isn't the answer to happier work. I've put a few of the things that I'm going to talk about now in a sort of a work manifesto. And I've tweeted that out from the handle for my podcast, but I'll share it with the event organisers. But they're just eight things, because actually the changes that most of us need to make work happier are actually immensely trivial. One of the ways that you can reduce your own stress, the quickest way to reduce your own stress is to take your phone, look at your mobile phone email app, and take the number off it. In fact, this is so effective. People who take the number off the amount of emails they've got, so effective that when the researchers who did that work were trying to get people to do it, to turn all alerts off for emails, to turn all notifications off, they asked people to turn it off for a week, and they couldn't get a sample size big enough because no one wanted to turn the alerts off for a week. So they asked people to do it for a day. That one day, turn the notifications and alerts off your emails for a day. It had such a measurable impact that half of all the people who did that were still doing it 2 years later. So it has, like, the ways that we'll improve work are often very trivial and really small. So here's the number one way that I think we can try and start improving work is just starting to presume permission. Because what we've done to work in the last 10 years, 15 years, is add more to it. And the thing that I've observed amongst a lot of people is that they find they don't know what they're permitted to do and what they're not permitted to do. Are they allowed to step away from their desk? Are they allowed to go and work in a coffee shop? Are they allowed to work from home for a morning? And there's been a sort of a real groundswell growing towards this. I interviewed a guy called Cal Newport, who's written a brilliant book called Deep Work. And Deep Work effectively is an answer to what we've tried to do to work in the last 15 years. This broadly a feeling that when the Industrial Revolution first came along, in fact, the first thing, or the later stages of the Industrial Revolution, when we moved from big engines to motors, really small electric motors, the first thing that happened is that they tried to replicate what the big engines had done with big motors. And then it was only over time that the recognition that the way that technology had changed, you can miniaturise things, you can make processes smaller. And what we've done in the last 15 years is we've kept work largely the same, and we've just added lots more on top of it. So Cal Newport talks about the fact that if we're going to accomplish anything, we need to think about deep work. The idea that we only accomplish anything when we're a process of sort of flow of significant thinking. And one of the things that he talks about, it gives several methodologies to achieve deep work. One of them is the monk mode morning. And I think that's most relevant to a lot of people. That's the idea that maybe on Wednesdays and Fridays, you work from home till 11:30, 12 o'clock, then you go into work and you engage with people. And so the idea that maybe people will be working in different places or quiet carriages in offices, I think is a big emergent thought. The challenge of working from home is that, number one, people who work from home, actually, the organisations that have very large amounts of working from home exhibit even lower productivity. And it's been a really bad year for working from home, and I recognise that. So effectively, the modern work is going to evolve to a state where organisations that have got the highest productivity do allow some of these mixed economy of people working a little bit from home to get things done or to work in a quiet environment. So back to that Francis Crick Institute, the thing that you most commonly hear about open plan offices is people say things like, I cannot get anything done. I go into work early just so I can power through emails. So we're in a situation where people feel overwhelmed by the 140 emails that we averagely receive a day and the inability to actually make progress on them. So deep work is, I think, sort of an emergent sense that we're going to try and counter that by allowing people to work in different ways. The next, I think, is like an emerging idea of trying to limit the amount that we are working. And so there's a few pieces of work on that. If you look at the capacity of the human brain, the maximum capacity of brain work during a week is 55 hours, based on sort of all the science. There's a book by Daniel Levitin called The Organized Mind, and there's a lot of work just looking at, can you add more to it? What you find when you look further into that is that 50 hours to 55 hours, the marginal increase, that what you accomplish in those extra hours is actually so small, you'd be crazy to prioritize work over leisure. So if you accept that the human mind has a capacity of 50 hours, and in fact, if you look at the US Bureau of Labor Statistics, say that the average American office worker does 3 hours work a day. So what's that, 15 hours a week the average person does? The capacity is 50 hours. You start working out that, okay, rather than more work being the goal, it's about doing productive work and achieving more in that productive time. And so thinking about how you can organise that or facilitate workplaces that allow people to do that. So allow people to take a break. And one of the biggest pieces of evidence that I've seen is the importance of taking a lunch. And the weird thing is, if you talk to French or Spanish people about this, they feel astonished that this is a debate or a discussion. You know, the British approach of eating al desco is now is so all pervasive that the idea of lunching together is actually sort of, it seems weird and unusual to Brits. But in fact, I chatted to an incredible organisation called Humanise. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this company, but they're really at the cutting edge of trying to work out how work is evolving. In fact, the guy from it was on my podcast this week, and they've taken the sort of badges that you're all wearing around your necks, and they've put mobile phone style technology in them. What it does is it allows you to measure the interactions between people. And you can track patterns of behaviour in the office. And the things that they've found, and the work by Ben Waber at Humanise is remarkable. The things that they found is that the number one thing that impacts an office dynamic and an office interaction is the location of the coffee machine. It has more impact, the location of the coffee machine, than the organisational chart, the org chart of the company. The next thing that impacts the interactions of teams in the office is the size of the lunch tables. In fact, they looked at organisations and they found that certain organisations, their work is remarkable. You'll find a lot of Ben Waber's stuff on YouTube. They found that some organisations, there were pockets of interactions between groups of four people. In others, it was far more expansive. It was like 11, 12 people. And they found it directly correlated to the size of the lunch tables in those organisations. If you put people in groups of three or four, people tend to only communicate in a work environment with people they've chatted to in other times. You tend not to wander over to the desk of someone you've not spoken to before. And so actually the size of lunch tables was one of the biggest indicators of office creativity. Taking a lunch break is really vital. Looking at that sort of capacity of the human mind, pausing and getting some renewal is a really important part. So actually sort of putting those down spaces in offices is really important. I'm going to show you two more things, and this is an interesting one. It relates to the phone voice thing, I think. So I think the idea of bringing your full self to work definitely would be the sort of idea that seems so soft and gentle that most people wouldn't necessarily consider it. But a guy called Dan Cable from London Business School did some work on this that was remarkable. And they found that they saw about a 15% productivity increase by such a trivial intervention that it's led them to explore a lot more. I'm going to show you all of the words now. So there's about 20 words on this slide because actually it was these 20 words and the input of 30 minutes that had that impact. So what they did, an organisation called WePro, which is a call centre. So call centres are, I almost fell off the stage then. Call centres are an immensely valuable place to look at the way that work's evolving, largely because they're really stressful places. If we want to see the evolution of stress in workplaces, you go and look at somewhere where people are connected all day and are shouted at for most of that time. And so they went to a call centre and they did this one exercise. And normally when you get people doing work, sort of trying to explore the future of work, they do a test exercise. They work out why that failed, and then they go and do something new. This was their test exercise. They turned up at a call center and they gave this to new hires. So this is new hires sitting in groups of new hires. There was no intervention by the bosses. And they said, can you spend half an hour doing this exercise? We want you in your groups of three to say, what's unique about you that leads to your happiest times at work? Reflect on a specific time when you were acting in the way you were born to act. So that was it. That was all they did. They gave that to people. What they found was that the customer satisfaction of those people went up from the call centre average of 61 to 73%. Also, when they went back 2 years later, the employee retention of those people was 58% higher. Now, all of those things, sort of, you know, numbers, numbers, numbers. But actually, if you found any organisation that was able to increase productivity by that percentage increase, they would introduce that change. So it's just an illustration that back to that thing that most of us are going to work to shut off. Actually, we present ourselves in a very artificial way in a working environment. If you can encourage that weirdness, that quirkiness, it actually has a very significant increase in productivity. The final one I'll show is back to sort of the reason why I sort of got into this is that truly, and I suspect most people here have been working for more than 10, 15 years, work used to be so much more fun than it is today. And, you know, emphatically that's the case. Work used to be so much more fun than it is now. And one of the things that's been lost is that there used to be a columnist at the Financial Times, a woman called Lucy Kellaway, who just left the Financial Times after 25 years and has just gone to become a maths teacher. And so she was in a reflective mode when she was leaving the Financial Times. And she says, the one thing that's changed, and she didn't want to feel like an arch conservative, but the one thing that's changed in modern offices is that there's no chat anymore. And I defy anyone to disagree with that, because, you know, if you go back to these horrible, wretched open plan offices that you guys have delivered to us, where no one can get anything done, the average state in most of these environments now is that you'll get a group of, we love blaming people, don't we? So let's blame millennials. A group of millennials with headphones on, just trying to get anything done. And the consequence of that is really measurable. Because back to the Ben Wabber and the badges around the neck, it all originates from the work of this guy, Sandy Pentland, from Alex Pentland, called Sandy, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he invented those badges around your neck. They call it people analytics. Effectively, he was able to track those pockets, those clusters of organisations. And what he found was that creative organisations are the ones where people chat face to face. And that's the thing that we've lost. That's the thing, as we've been peering into our phones, frowning into our screens, just to try and get down to 100 emails, to try and stop the woman next to us talking about I'm a celebrity, to try and just get anything done. Actually, the thing we've lost in the last 15 years is chat. And I know that the idealised version of open plan offices is it was going to facilitate far more interactions, far more sort of serendipitous discussions. All of the evidence is that it did exactly the opposite. People have fewer discussions in open plan offices than they did before. And the great thing is that people like Sandy Pentland are starting to give evidence on that. So we put all of it into a new work manifesto. And like I say, they're really small changes. Having a lunch break seems almost so pedestrian that why would anyone put it on a list? Because it directly impacts people's happiness and people's productivity. So small changes. The world of work has radically changed in the last 15 years, but we've sort of sleepwalked into it. And we've been left in a state where none of us are getting anything more done, but stress and unhappiness is higher than ever before. So I entered into it sort of with a real desire to see how I could improve my own workspace, but I've come sort of pretty obsessive about that. Thank you very much.
So my name's Matt, and I've been at Facebook just over 7 years now, which actually makes me a bit of a dinosaur in the company that's just 13 years old. And what I'm doing now is working on our workplace team, which is the first product which Facebook has built and designed exclusively in London, outside of the US. So it's really exciting for us to be able to say that this is the first thing. What is Workplace? Think of it as a private Facebook for your employees. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that, but that's effectively what it is. I wanted to just start by taking a quick look at kind of some of the ways that we're communicating today, tell you a little bit about the Workplace story, and then also share some ideas on what I think it can do for you. So if we sort of take a step back and think about how we communicate in our lives today, it's really changed over the last few years. If you think about how you use email in your personal life versus how you might use something like WhatsApp or Instagram, right? People no longer communicate just in text. We're really, much more comfortable sharing images, and the amount of video that people consume and share today is phenomenal. And the ways that we communicate, are very, very different to those ways that we've been used to over the last few years. So if you think about, you might have a WhatsApp group with your family, you might have a friend who you only communicate exclusively in GIFs. The point is that, that's okay because that's what you expect, and there are many different services and ways for you to communicate with your friends and your family, and they're amazing, right? They're really powerful. But the reality of the world of work is it's something a little bit like this, right? The screen's a bit blurry, but kind of adds to the effect, I guess. And obviously this is an exaggeration, right? But the difference between how we communicate in our daily lives and how we communicate at work is absolutely huge. And so what we're seeing is that companies who are starting to embrace these kind of new ways of communicating, embracing means of communication that we're used to in our daily lives, are actually these next generation companies who are, you know, becoming much more open and democratic, breaking down silos and giving access to all people within the organization. So let's talk a little bit about workplace and kind of where it came from. If we go back in time to 2011, this is Mark Zuckerberg talking at our annual F8 developers conference, and he was talking about this thing called Facebook groups. And we'd seen this quite interesting trend where people on Facebook had started to create groups with people that they didn't know. So not their friends, but people in their community to talk about, you know, community initiatives, sports teams, and more interestingly, to start to talk about work. So we saw this trend happening, and internally, we were 20% of the size we are now. We were growing incredibly quickly. Offices were springing up all around the world, and we were really struggling to communicate with each other in a way that we kind of felt was effective and allowed us to kind of keep that startup mentality that, you know, had always been there. So those two things together, we, you know, using some of the principles and the values that Rob showed before, we basically hacked together a solution, which was private groups on Facebook for Facebook employees, because we were all connected on Facebook and it just felt like the right thing to do and the easiest thing to do. And suddenly this became the way in the company that we would communicate. From top-down perspective, so from Mark sharing his thoughts about the strategy of the company to, you know, teams and projects working on things together. And so the idea was born that perhaps this is something that, you know, people outside of the company might want to use. And we spent about a year and a half with a small group of companies, about 400 companies, really understanding, was this something that Facebook, the big consumer company, could make and could be useful and valuable for the world of enterprise. And then in 2016, after some pretty strong feedback, but this was the worst name we could have called it, Facebook at Work, we changed it to Workplace. And fast forward today, and we now have 30,000 companies using the platform. So as I mentioned earlier, it's really, think of it as a private Facebook for your employees, and it's really designed to help you work more effectively and more collaboratively, okay? It's totally separate from consumer Facebook as well. You as the company own the access and the deactivation of the accounts, so the two things are completely separate. And I think, as mentioned, you know, it's really designed for this new world of work. So in the environment that you all work in, I think it's really interesting to think about how is this platform something that could be could create a closer connection between all of those people who work for you, and regardless of where they are. It's an easy and familiar platform that you don't need to teach people how to use, and it's really a catalyst for helping people to work more collaboratively, sharing insight and best practice. I'll just show you a couple of examples of some of the customers who are using the platform in the UK, and really the thing that ties them all together is this question of how do we better communicate with our staff, both from a top-down perspective and both from a teams and projects perspective. How do we give people intuitive tools that they, you know, understand how to use, and give them access to information more quickly, and enable them to react to scenarios on the ground and in real time?
Well, I'm uplifted.
Yeah, I am. I'm uplifted all over again. I don't really know. Was there a word for re-uplifted? There isn't, is there?
No.
I've probably just taken an hour of what was, you know, a pretty intelligent, intellectual podcast and ruined it.
Yeah, but, sorry. You know, people probably turned off before they got to this anyway.
Yeah, they probably did. Or they were expecting it.
Yeah,
so either
used
way,
to it by now.
That's a win.
So we really only have 1 week left before Christmas because I'm leaving. Well, not leaving.
I was going to say, you might want to clarify.
Yeah, I'm going away for some time.
That makes it sound very mysterious.
Yeah, well, I'd like to leave it like that. So you'll hear from us one more time before Christmas. We might even do a little bit of a compilation, who knows, of some of the best bits of of tech talk. I don't know how long that will be. Might be a short one.
Yeah. I think there was one bit where I was talking about having bits of phone glass screen stuck in my face whilst on the phone call from New York. That would definitely make the cut.
Yeah.
Pun intended. Okay, should we leave it there? Because
let's leave it there.
Make it worse.
Yeah, well, it's just giving us more...
fodder.
Yeah. Anyway, hope you enjoyed that, everyone. We will, I was going to say see you, but we won't. But we will talk at you next week. Cheerio.
Bye.